If the family's so important, oh, it's so important. You say it's the most important. Does the Bible even tell us how it's supposed to run? Yeah. Run your home and your dough like a biblical boss. Before we get into today's subject, we here at Abraham's Wallet, we did a recent episode about what the new administration is going to mean financially. And this guy, this Trump guy, is signing executive orders like there's a sale going on and there's a clearance sale on them. And he's making declarations. I don't know if all these things can come to pass just because he waves a magic presidential wand. But there's been a couple things that have caught my eye. And one of them is just yesterday, he signed an order saying everything from, I don't have a Trump impersonation, but everything from Mexico and Canada is going to have a 25% tariff on it. I assume he's going to try to lash out at China at some point too. What do those things mean to rank and file humans going to the grocery store?
Yeah, well, I have to caveat my answer for posterity, right? Because we record our episodes before they get released. So sure. It's possible.
That's just one of our little habits, is that we record them before they get released.
Yeah.
This a lot of people, if they're on the cutting edge, they'll record them after they're being. We just kind of do it old fashioned.
This is not a live show. Unless you have complaints, then you can call the live hotline and share them yes. Right here on the air. So there's always a chance that anything I would say about tariffs has changed by the time this comes out, because it's a dynamic topic. But it's a question that I got 5 minutes ago from one of our clients.
And
he said, hey, Mark, how do these tariffs that Trump's threatening to impose, are they going to help us? Are they going to hurt us? I trust you with my wealth, but should we be doing anything differently? And it's such a roller coaster right now, because initially everybody was worried. They said tariffs, you know, I'm reading a book right now about the roaring 20s from a financial perspective.
Oh, interesting.
And in 1921, we had a dramatic deregulation of markets and an increase in tariffs, which sounds a lot like what Trump is talking about doing, right?
Yeah.
And the result was the roaring 20s. We had the biggest boomtown in the history of our country from a financial asset growth standpoint. Everybody was getting in on the stock market for the first time. There was a lot of money just kind of flowing around. So it was good times. As long as we don't talk about 1929 and what happened at the end of that decade, which was, you know, Black Thursday and the Great Depression kicked off. And so I think people have been worried. Is Trump going to just grind our economy to a halt by making everything more expensive and taxing the snot out of anything that gets imported? He's kind of backed off of some of that rhetoric. And that's actually, best I can tell, why the market did really well last week when we're recording this. Now, it's a fickle thing, the stock market, as we talk about on here often. So they'll say, well, we're super excited that he's backed off of the really draconian tariff talk and he's not actually going to shut us down. I'll say some tariffs, I think, can be a good thing. Jeff Davenport and I, we were recording our best books of the year episode, and we were talking, I forget why, we got onto the topic of, like, when we were growing up children in the 80s, the Russians were the enemy of everybody, right? And we were unabashed in our movies. We need a bad guy. We'll make him a Russian. I think that we have a legitimate economic and military enemy in China. And a lot of people are afraid to say that, but they're our enemy. They would like to overtake us in every way. So I don't think it's bad, even if it wasn't going to make my stock portfolio go up, to take some measures to make sure that American industry is protected against things like that. And you can overdo it. So right now we're in wait and see mode. You know, I could imagine that guacamole will become more expensive because all of our avocados come from south of the border. You know, if Trump actually wants to tax all of those at 25%, I'd be willing personally, if I was at the negotiating table with the Donald, I'd say, you take out all those people who are here that aren't supposed to be here and leave us our cheap guacamole. We could make that trade. Less.
Isn't there a middle ground? Can't we work together?
Less avocado tariffs, more deportations of people who have entered the country illegally.
So what's the bottom line?
I think we're probably going to get like a moderated version of all the rhetoric. I think that China probably stands to suffer the most if we do what we ought to do. But I've been keeping my investment exposure to China pretty low for a few years now. I've talked about it on this podcast because they're not having babies. And it's hard to be a growth leader in the world, no matter how good you are at technology.
Wow, what a great point.
If you refuse to reproduce, there's some biblical principles that would also tell you that's a bad idea to refuse to reproduce.
But, yeah.
If Trump goes nuts with tariffs, then I would have a worse expectation for growth. But I'm already pretty diversified. And this is why people are like, why would you invest in international, in European companies? American companies have been crushing them for the last 6 years. Well, it's because every time there's always an asset class that's winning. And if you just chase that asset class, then whenever something happens, like maybe our government gets a little tariff happy, then it's too late. You've already missed the boat. And
yes,
that's why we stay diversified across asset classes and investments all the time and don't try to time the market, even when we have hunches that X, Y, or Z is going to happen politically.
I love that. Thank you, Mark. Let me ask you one last question about the Trump stuff.
I know what you're going to ask because we're talking about the order of the household today.
Yeah.
And I agree. Yes, you should consider diversifying your wife. Like, take a wife from another foreign land. It's allowed now. You can do it.
Holy
cow. So if you're a young man listening to this, it's one area where I think international exposure is a positive.
Well, I've done that. I've diversified the manual family tree. I got an export from Mexico. No tariff.
I'm just saying one time, not if you're listening to this and you've been married for 15 years, I'm not advocating that you add to your portfolio.
Okay. You're talking really to the single guys out there. Don't be afraid to diversify.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wait, what were you really going to ask me?
I was really going to ask you, it seems like big picture, if we could just summarize the early returns of the Trump administration, they are definitely putting at least a temporary halt in major ways to government spending. They are putting a halt on hiring. They're threatening to cut out entire sectors of the government. They're trying to minimize government spending. Yeah, that's just an armchair quarterback observer's conclusion. They are trying to raise income streams that are not taxing our own citizenry. There is talk, we shall see, but there is talk of reducing taxation on people. So you're a great person to ask this to because your university training was in economics. So you, do you say economics or economics, Mark?
I think I say economics, but you were an econ major, so I don't know. But
yeah, maybe it's one of those things.
Yeah.
Okay, so my question is, if these trends hold and they do what they appear to be doing and you extend that out to 4 years of policy, are we all richer at the end of 4 years? Does the nation pull out of its debt-ridden landslide? Does it start to nose up? And do we start feeling like, wow, we're more prosperous?
Yeah, I mean... barring the unknown, then I would say yes. Now, it's the thing that I don't think people realize, and we've talked about it a bunch, is that cutting spending will reduce inflation. I think it's so funny that we talked about it, I think, in the tax episode with Jed, but The Inflation Reduction Act was basically a gigantic spending bill.
Of course.
Which for sure increased inflation. And so people go, well, I'm mad at the president because my dozen eggs used to cost $2 and now they cost $6. That's real inflation.
They cost $7.50, by the way.
For you?
Yes.
Oh, my noble wife just bought a 60 count case of eggs because that's all they had at our Costco, because I guess the chickens got sick and so you can only buy them in massive bulk now. My point was, we might go through a time, whether it's because of tariffs or just because we're not going to spend a bunch of money to hand out dollars, whether it's to individual families like we did post COVID, or even to producers, like we're going to maybe stop subsidizing electric vehicles. Well, everybody who thought they needed an electric vehicle is going to go, dang it, inflation, I'm spending more on my car now because I don't have this subsidy. But the truth is, yeah, you might see higher prices. The invisible tax that inflation is on you as an everyday American, though, is so much higher than you realize.
Yes.
That just by cutting spending, if we can stop inflation from continuing upwards and we can stop printing more money, you actually have incentive now to invest your money and grow it instead of just immediately spending it. So that's where I would say the good things that can happen aren't just the things that are immediately visible when the economic data comes out periodically and we go, well, we grew this much, or the deficit shrunk this much. We can actually do good things for the average American household. Even if you make the same amount of money and pay the same taxes, if your dollars will buy a much greater share of what they buy today in 10 years, well, then you're doing a lot better than if your dollars are worth half in 10 years what they are today. I think probably the biggest thing that the government is looking at doing is not just can we balance the budget and cut the deficit, but it's also, can we make Americans kind of realign the economic system to incentivize saving again? And hopefully, my dream is that we can do it without, you know, abandoning the Federal Reserve altogether and throwing that in the trash and going to all Bitcoin or gold standard again or something like that. But I know you and I maybe feel a little differently about that.
Okay, I'm going to leave that alone. But your money that's sitting in cash is losing value. So we strongly recommend that except for the money that you're using like in your checking account to pay bills and get through the month, if you have a little savings account on the side, you've got to put that into a interest-bearing savings account. You should be making money on all your dollars. And we have biblical reasons to go put your dollars to work. If they're not working for you in your home to pay for bills, they should be working on the side. So I just see that repeatedly with people that they're like, well, we think we might be doing a down payment next year. So we have $60,000 sitting here on the side and we're just waiting to hold that. And I just go, what's that money doing? Well, we're just waiting on that money. You got to put that money to work or it's losing value year to year, right?
Yeah. I mean, I always tell people, make an emergency fund. That's a real thing. That's cash, but we don't tell you to put it in Fifth Third Bank where they're going to pay you 0.1% per year. We say, find the highest yield savings you can find,
yes.
Which might keep up with inflation sometimes. But it's not going to, you're not going to lose it at nearly the same pace regardless. And then beyond that, not only some people come to us and we're like, well, we have work to do. We're going to save for the next 9 months to get that emergency fund built. But some people come to us, as you know, Steve, and they go, well, I've got $300,000 in cash. And we go, we still want to talk about emergency fund, but mostly so that you'll take all the rest of that and deploy it.
Yes.
Whether that's in stocks and bonds or assets or your business or what, that just don't leave it there doing nothing for you, even in a high yield savings account, because people are learning this year pretty quickly. High yield savings account is no longer an easy free home run. It's like, yep. Oh, this keeps going down every month. So
that's right. That's right. Okay. So let me start to pivot. Why do we talk about money? Sorry, I'm going to give you a little back end of Abraham's wallet here. Why do we talk about money so much? Because money is one of the main tools that God gives us to learn how to rule. And where's the place that money matters the most? It's in the home. What does that matter? Why do we talk about the home and family? Well, we did a episode 5 or 6 months ago called The True Headquarters of God's Kingdom. And the point is that God intends to raise up his sons to lead. And the thing that he wants them to lead is not primarily businesses. It's not primarily church organizations. It's not primarily the Little League baseball team. Primarily, he wants to raise sons to lead families. And that's what we say is the true headquarters of God's kingdom. Okay, so that's why we talk about money. Because if you have huge money issues, you got problems in your family. I mean, these are foundational basic things. It's also true if you have big problems in your marriage. So here's what I want to get to today is that often my sort of pulse check on what's kind of happening or what'd be helpful for us to talk about or review is human conversations. I meet with a lot of people on a weekly basis. I find this repeated need to review just the basic concept of the running of a household. So if the family's so important, it's so important. You say it's the most important. Does the Bible even tell us how it's supposed to run? Yeah, it does tell us how it's supposed to run. There's a lot in the Bible about how a family's supposed to run. It talks about how we're supposed to treat the elderly. It talks a lot about the way that we're supposed to work with our spouses and be in covenant with them. It talks about what husbands are supposed to do and leading and working and teaching the Bible at home, and tells wives what to do in this structure, and that you're supposed to tend to the culture of your home and your train, and tells children what to do very specifically. It talks about welcoming the outsider and under your roof, letting your light shine before men. Those verses are not saying you need to go be a foreign missionary in another country. They're saying that in your home, you need to let your light shine. You welcome people. There's a lot about hospitality in the scriptures. We've talked about that. Multiplying and filling the earth is one of the basic commands of the Bible. It's all the way back at the beginning of Genesis. How do you multiply? Not at your church, not at the Little League team, I hope. It's in home. It's at home. It's in your home. So the way that you execute on God's kingdom is in your home. How do we subdue it? Well, you learn how to rule. How do you learn how to rule? Well, by doing things like managing your money and your home. So the Bible has a lot to say about the way that families work. I would like to just throw out by contrast, the Bible says comparatively little about how church organizations are supposed to run. That's why you see a lot of theories, a lot of working theories out there about, well, we do this kind of government in our church. We do this kind of government. Well, we base it on this verse. We base it on this one verse. Because we don't have a book of the Bible that goes, now here's how the church organization is supposed to work. We look at these things. We get little peaks of church government. There's a lot in the Bible about how a family's supposed to run. And I would say that's one of the proofs that this is God's got his eye on this thing. I think he's maybe a little bit more generous about how church governments work. How do you want to? I don't know, you run that thing the way you want, but he's very prescriptive about the way a family works.
I've talked to a bunch about that little, I don't know how long it was, 5-minute clip that you did on our Instagram back in the day on this very topic. And I just don't think we could hit it frequently enough. So when you said, I want to go through this again, I don't know if you were expecting an eye roll from me, but I got excited. I love revisiting this topic. And I also kind of love the fact that this is probably one of the topics that is like a dividing line amongst
it definitely
people
is.
Who hear us. Is some people, if you're new to Abraham's Wallet, you might hear this episode and go, this is not for me. So that doesn't make me sad. I mean, I want you to be on the same page as the king of the universe. So yeah, that makes me sad if you're not. But it kind of makes me excited that there's some clear instructions for how we run our home, and it's way bigger than which stocks and bonds you pick or whether tariffs happen. It's foundational to whether you're building the type of family that can succeed over the long term. So I'm buckled in, I'm ready. I'll chip in as I'm able to, but I think it strikes me the lines that you have drawn have fallen in pleasant places for me.
Okay, rock and roll. Well, let me say this about all of our, I hope this is true. If you are just checking us out and you go, what are these guys' perspective, where they're coming from? You're going to hear, I mean, I've talked a lot to this point. I don't think I've quoted any Bible verses. You're going to get editorial from us where we're commenting on the foundation that we must not argue with, which is God's word. So I'm going to be reading some Bible passages, and those things are golden. Like they're not to be corrected. In the men's Bible study I'm a part of called a Midrash, one of the things that we say to each other is we mustn't be embarrassed about any part of God's word. We just have to let it be what it is. And then if it condemns all of us, or it condemns the society in which we live, so be it. Because, well, let me quote a Bible verse to you, let God be right and every man proved a liar. That's, there you go. So I'm going to, the basis of everything I have to say is going to be based on two passages. It's really one verse and then a longer passage. That's the heart of what I have to put before you today. I just think it's helpful to kind of describe that and tease it out to people. And as I've done that in the last month with a handful of guys, they've all gone, this is so eye-opening and refreshing to me. I actually had a guy say to me this week, I've never heard these things before. And this is a church-going guy. So I shed a tear and I go, well, then I'm going to shout them all the louder if they're not being said. Okay, I'm going to start with, I guess I'm not starting at 25 minutes, but one thing I would like to do is I would like to read an excerpt from an article we wrote back in the day on the website. You remember what a blog is, Mark?
Yeah, I do. We used to blog.
Okay. So we still have a website, abrahamswallet.com. And I was looking at our archive list. It is a rock solid list of articles to read. If you're a young man and you like, I would like to triangulate where I am in the universe. If you walk through our archives, there's like a guide. If you click on the page that says archives, there's like a guide. Here's all the things about the structure of the family. Here's things about investing. It's great. So anyways, one of those articles that's still on our website is called What is Family? That we hearken back to May of 2018, a simpler time. Simpler time. Okay.
That was back when you could buy a truck for cheap.
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to read three paragraphs. So hang with me as I read from What is Family? You did not invent you, and I did not invent me. We were made, and as such, there is purpose imbued in us. Likewise, family is not something we have arrived at by our wits, nor is it something the universe or chance has worked out for us. Family was very particularly created by God, given to the very first humans ever, and our Father has left us plentiful instructions for proceeding with his invention and having it work properly. Aren't we glad we have Bibles? Without them, how would we know how to live? Without the timeless reliability of God's instructions, we're left with our feelings, our short-sightedness, and whatever culture happens to cough up. These all sound like terrible ideas, what I had given some references earlier in the article about people marrying robots, etc. Terrible ideas. Don't do any of them. Don't ever put Kool-Aid or root beer into your automobile's fuel tank, even if it just feels right. Don't do it. Don't stick knives into electrical sockets. And don't try to get a model for family anywhere other than the scriptures. Creator God knows best. And his concept of family brings the following truths into light. One, family establishes a foundation of security and confidence from which one can advance into the world and achieve all manner of wonderful things, relationships, innovations, discovery, physical achievement. None of these things, by the way, ever produce the centered confidence that family does. We're all created with a deep, vast craving for acceptance, and this God-given need is met first and best in family. Number two, family defines a band of people to which we're bound for life. The Bible calls this kind of relationship a covenant. This means we have to put up with others' foibles, and our foibles are put up with as well. We have to learn negotiation, consideration, accommodation, and other really good A-T-I-O-N words. We're never, ever getting away from these people, so we have to learn how to make the best of it, a helpful life skill. If you run from all your problems, your life is doomed. Number three, family is the place where we can learn respect, obedience, submission to authority, and honoring of other human beings. Number four, family is a living memory bank of our own story. All your living relatives who know the story of your family know you in an important, centering way. The family collectively creates an identity for all its members. Number five, family is the God-given receptacle for wealth, and the stewardship thereof is a necessary skill that dramatically affects life outside the family. And lastly, number six, family is the God-ordained place for us to receive and someday give love without strings attached. It's the place we learn mercy, grace, and permanent acceptance. Okay. I open that up to just establish that this thing is so key, and the Bible tells us how it's supposed to work, okay? Here's the verse. Here, big drum roll, deep breath. Here's the verse that I trot out that I think is the best summary in the whole Bible of the structure of the family. And it is also polarizing, and I don't know, you might have to click away after hearing this Bible verse. But I want you to know, you're going to be offended at the Bible and not offended at me. Here it comes. It's 1 Corinthians 11:3. I trot this out to guys, and what I do with them is I get out a piece of paper and I say, you read this verse, and I'm going to draw the hierarchy of the household as you read this verse. And it's a real simple org chart. Ready? I want you to understand that Christ is the head, that is the authority over every man. All right, I can see those two bubbles in a line connecting them, Christ and man. And man is the head of woman. All right, I see another bubble with a line. And God is the head of Christ. There it is. There's your org chart. I see four bubbles, God, Christ, man, woman. That's how a family operates. And like, discuss. And everybody's like, I don't know. I don't know about that. I've got some severe problems with what you're saying. It's real simple. And we don't like it. But there's an org chart. Before we proceed, I know that you have hot sports takes bubbling in your heart. Mark, what do you think?
I have two thoughts. One, as the listeners will know, we always read a passage of scripture before we eat. And last night we had a friend of one of my daughters over who had never been exposed to any of this. And we're just making our way through 1 Corinthians. And sure enough, we land right here last night.
Oh,
and her eyes got real big. As I said, the head of every man is woman. No, I didn't.
Other way around.
The head of every woman is man.
Yeah.
And so we talked through it a bit. And what you're not saying, but what everyone who hears this will try to say that you're saying, if you read this out loud,
yeah,
is God thinks men are the most important and valuable, and then women are sort of not as important and valuable.
Of course.
Because in our culture, right?
Of course.
Seniority on the org chart at the stupid XYZ company where you send your wife off to make spreadsheets for some other man's family. Yeah. That's what determines value, not slotting into their God-ordained role and function in a household, which is, spoiler alert, what actually is corresponds to someone's value inside the family. But anyways,
yeah,
I just I think those are my two thoughts. Is one, you're gonna get raised eyebrows if you ever read this out loud in public or in your living room, but you happen to have people who haven't heard it before. And two, people who hear this, because we're so conditioned to think about value and role, in especially like any sort of headship would be meaning subordination, not only in role, but also in value. And people just, it blows their brains up and they are angry before they can even, you can get a word out. So
yes,
keep those things in mind as you read this.
Yes. I think what you're hitting at is the fact that we as a culture are so against submission. And I make a point in a class that we lead called Critical Skills, where we kind of talk about strongholds of the past, that one of the national strongholds of the United States is a spirit of rebellion. So the idea of we always talk about the Marlboro man. He lives out on the edge of the frontier and he just smokes cigarettes and nobody tells him what to do. And rebel without a cause. And the cool guy is always somebody that nobody tells him what to do. That's kind of an American myth, that picture of the lone rebel. And that's one of our problems. And it's so deep into us that the idea of telling someone to submit, even if it's your own child, there's something about that. It's a little bit uncomfortable. And certainly to say, here's the curious thing about that passage, to tell a woman that she has to submit to a man, it's very uncomfortable. We're not used to seeing that somewhere. Again, we feel we need to apologize for a God who would say this. Let's all just observe in that verse that every man also has to submit, and he has to submit to the God of the universe and to the scriptures, which, as Jesus would say, is more demanding than any human could be, because this is a God who looks into the motivations of your heart. He looks into your thoughts. And I mean, it's very demanding. It's very rigorous to follow this God. And also baked into that verse, I think, is fascinating, is that our hero, Jesus, lived for 33 years, and he also lived in submission. And he said at the end of his life, "Not my will, but yours be done." Very strong words of the most submissive man who ever lived, who happens to be the Savior of the world. So there's something about submission throughout the picture that just is distasteful to an American. I think it's good to call out. And the most helpful thing that I've come up with in talking with men about this, because they have been conditioned to think, are you saying that a woman never gets to speak? That she must frighteningly scurry around, never to disturb the ogre husband who is domineering in every category of life? Is that what you're saying about a woman? I always say, guys, let's just consider, this is just an org chart. So let's consider you at work. If you have a corporate job, do you have a boss? Yes. Okay. Does your boss tell you things to do that you have other thoughts on? Oh yeah, all the time. We're spending time with a young man who works in a Lego store. And he's a part-time employee at the Lego store. And I go, does the boss ever tell you, you need to put this display up on this side of the store? And you're thinking, that's probably not the right place for that display. I'm out there all day. We should put it over here because that's where the 8-year-old boys are going to be hanging out. They're going to be interested in the Death Star over here. He's like, I have those thoughts all the time. I said, okay, so do you do what he says? Yes. And do you, frustrated and insulting when you do them? Struggle with it a little bit sometimes. Okay. So let's just talk about what submission looks like. I learned this. I didn't grow up with this. I grew up very rebellious to authority, but I learned somewhere along the way that submission means that I'm to bring the benefits of my perspective to the one that I'm in submission to. And he would go to his boss and say, okay, I want you to know you're the boss. I'm going to do what you say at the end of the day. But I recognize my perspective is we should put the display somewhere else. I think we'd get better traffic and we'd actually sell more if we put it over here. What do you think of that, boss? And I said, does this ever happen with you? He said, it happens all the time. And I said, what does your boss say? He said, he usually says, yeah, you do have a better perspective on that than I do. That's fine. Let's move it over there. And he says, sometimes he'll go, actually, we got this floor layout from the district. And so we don't have a choice. So this is what we're doing. And he goes, and I go, okay. And I'm just trying to describe to him the peace that you feel from sharing with your higher up the benefit of your perspective. And at the end of the day going like, okay, I'm going to do what you say. And I get to be at peace about it because I'm not actually responsible for the things you're responsible for. I'm just responsible to follow you. So this org chart describes responsibility and authority. Those two things baked in together. I see one is they go hand in hand. Authority is the kind of ability to do the things you want to do. Responsibility is like, oh, I've got to answer for this. And I want to make one point about that org chart in 1 Corinthians 11:3. From where I sit, maybe in the experience of it day to day, it's more frightening for a woman on that org chart because I don't know what this guy is going to tell me to do. Can I trust everything that every leader piece of leadership he gives? Not really. He's just a guy. So in the day to day, that seems the most scary. At the end of the day, when it's all said and done, the man's place seems the scariest to me because he's going to answer to the king of the universe. And if I can quote James 4:12, it says, there is one lawgiver and judge who is able to save and destroy. But you, who are you to judge your neighbor? Like that lawgiver who's able to save and destroy, that's who men are going to be answering to for the way they run their homes. So just a couple of thoughts. I want guys who are walking through the hierarchy of the household to have practical, know how it works. And I think that the job illustration is the best way to kind of put that across. So what I think kind of can soften the edges of this topic, because as you say, there's something we go to this cataclysmic place when we read this verse. It just sounds insane that a human being would be submission to another human being. Well, of course, that's the way it works with children. Are you perfect in the way that you raise your children? Well, of course not. Well, so what am I supposed to, you know what we should do? Just relent and have no responsibility over our kids and let them just run roughshod. No, you do your best. You humble yourself. And when you screw up, you say, I screwed up. And then you continue to lead. That's how it works. And that's how it's supposed to work in marriage and in the hierarchy of the home. Okay. And so the interesting thing is that the Bible appreciates this tension. And I want to read a passage to you from 1 Peter 3, where it's so clear that Peter and Paul, who wrote 1 Corinthians, they're all reading off the same page. They understand the exact same picture. And all of the passages, we could read Ephesians 5, all of the passages that described family life, the Bible is so consistent in the way that it draws this picture. And what I want to pull out of 1 Peter 3 is how there is kind of an understanding disposition to it. Like, hey, I know this is tough, okay? So let me read this to you. He's going to change the subject at the beginning of 1 Peter 3. And he says, he's making a pivot from what he said in chapter 2. Now, in the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands. I'm going to read from the Amplified Bible. And the Amplified Bible tries to give a little description that will help us understand the flavor of the original language. So it kind of overtalks purposefully the Amplified Bible. And here's what it says. In the same way, you wives, be submissive to your own husbands, subordinate, not as inferior, but out of respect for the responsibilities entrusted to husbands and their accountability to God. So partnering with them. Do you hear the understanding that's in that verse? That a wife would say to herself, my husband's going to answer to God for what we do. That's kind of tough. So that even if, I'm going to keep reading, so that even if some of them do not obey the word of God, you've got a husband that doesn't obey the word of God, they might be won over to Christ without discussion by the godly lives of their wives. When they see your modest and respectful behavior, together with your devotion and appreciation, love your husband, encourage him, and enjoy him as a blessing from God. Now, there's a whole section here that's about the way that you follow your husband and the way that you dress and your hair. I'm going to skip past that down to verse 7 because I'm interested in the fact that it's kind of going like, ladies, it's tough to be a husband. Can you give a little understanding to that? Verse 7, listen to this. In the same way, you husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, with great gentleness and tact, and with an intelligent regard for the marriage relationship, as with someone physically weaker, since she's a woman, show her honor and respect as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered or ineffective. I like that. I like that. I see Jesus kind of pulling his sword out of the scabbard a little bit, just showing you there's a sharp blade there, fellas. And it says, so that your prayers will not be hindered or ineffective. And God is definitely saying, you mistreat one of my daughters. You abuse her. I want you to know I'm watching you. I'm paying close attention to the way that you're treating your wife. And then there's a closing passage starting with verse 8. Finally, all of you be like-minded, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, humble in spirit. Never return evil for evil or insult for insult. Avoid scolding, berating, and any kind of abuse. On the contrary, give a blessing. And it goes on from there. My point is, I feel like those are great companion. That's a great companion passage to 1 Corinthians 11:3, because it's like, hey, I want us to appreciate the fact these are hard jobs. A woman who has to submit to a husband, according to 1 Peter 3, even if he's not leading in a godly way, she still has to submit to him. That's what it says. Does that sound like a hard, scary position to be in? Yeah, that sounds a little bit intimidating to do that. Okay, guys, understand that she's in a tough position. Try to be gracious to her. Can you do that? And then he turns to the lady. Ladies, understand that this guy's responsible for your entire household. Can you be gracious to him? Can you give him some support? Is that all making sense? What I'm saying about that there's a little bit of heart and it puts flesh on the bone, where 1 Corinthians 11:3 is just harsh. Look, this is the way the hierarchy works. And then that 1 Peter 3 passage, like, guys, let's be considerate of each other.
Yeah, I mean, I really like the image of Jesus kind of. He's like the Mexican gangster that lifts up the shirt just a little bit and is like, oh, there's a Glock in that belt.
That's right.
There.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's gentle, I guess. He's encouraging gentleness and responsibility, but also kind of saying, and if you choose to ignore this warning, consequences will be steep. So I like it.
Yeah, that's really the main thing that I wanted to say. I have to make this point because, when you get, husbands and wives together, you have to say this to them because it's so easy for us. We're so self-centered. God bless us, everyone, that we think about, well, I mean, my job's hard. Yeah. But look at this person that I'm married to. How are they doing on that? My wife's not doing very good at the submission thing. And the wives listening might be thinking, well, my husband's not doing very good at the like leading us the way God would lead us. And by the way, that's the hierarchy means that very thing. That think of the husband role as a, you know, regional manager where he's getting something from the vice president of the company going like, we're going to change the uniform policy. So, okay, I got that from headquarters. Now he comes to the district managers and he's going, listen, we're changing the uniform policy. His job is to give a perfectly accurate representation of what is coming eventually from headquarters. He's not allowed to editorialize on that. He has to say, this is what the boss are saying. We're going to do this thing. It's very common. I know this from experience that the people on the bottom end will kvetch to him. I don't like the fact that we're changing. I like the old uniforms. That happens. And his job isn't to like, well, here's what I think. You know what? We're going to cool it on the collars thing. We can do collars. No, you can't do it however you want. You have to stay true. So this man job is about knowing what the king says and faithfully reproducing that under your roof. That's why we're even reading these passages, because that's the job, is to faithfully reproduce it. That is such an important job. And then wives have a difficult job also, which is, I'm going to take what I'm getting from God's leader that he put in our household, and I'm going to represent him by the way that, I don't know, we do spending, by the way we treat technology in our home, the way that we do obedience. I'm reinforcing what he's saying. These are hard jobs, okay? And these are downlines. This is cascading downlines. So as I was saying, it's our tendency to kind of go like, I'm doing okay, but what about this spouse I'm connected to? And I just want to make this comment. And the comment is, now this is, you're going to hear Stephen's editorial. This is not a Bible verse. This is what I have come up with after kind of working with couples for 20 plus years. Here's my comment. It's none of your business how your spouse does their job. So you've got a wife who has trouble submitting because of her family of origin, the culture she's in, I don't know what. You could pray for her, but it's not your job to berate her into submission. Her obedience to her role is between her and God. Similarly, we just saw this in 1 Peter 3. It's definitely spelled out in 1 Peter 3. That if a man is not leading his household in the ways of God, wife, it is not your job to try to nag him into obedience with God. That's not your job. It's none of your business, really, what God is saying to him. Your job is to be, look at the hierarchy, is to be responding to him as the leader of your home. So that's between him and God, and he will definitely answer to God for how he leads. Your job is to, however he's leading, I want to be following him faithfully. Let me say it again. Men, it is between your wife and God how she is submitting to you. And you don't volunteer to your spouse, that's not really submissive what you did there, what you pulled off there. Similarly, we've heard this many times for a wife to go, you weren't exactly laying down your life for me there. If we do that, if we're getting into finger pointing and accusation, these are the seeds of great pain inside a marriage. So that's one of my, that's a Stephen tip. What do you reckon to my tip?
I've seen stories where a wife just went at her husband over and over and over, and the marriage went down, 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 down. I've seen stories where a husband thought he was going to bow up on his wife and say, now, honey, I've decided to take the reins and you can sit yourself down and submit to me. And
yes,
the marriage goes down, 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 down.
Yes.
And I don't think many people hear it, but I have also seen a story where a husband said, I'm out on Jesus. I'm walking away. And the wife dedicated herself to prayer. And that's it. I'm just going to pray for him. I'm going to press into my relationship with Jesus and pray for him earnestly over a period of years. And I've seen that husband come back to the Lord. And in hindsight, he goes, well, I think it's because of my praying wife, but she didn't ever say a word to me. Now, I'm not saying you can't ever say a word. I don't say think you watch your spouse careen off the edge. If my wife comes home and there's a bunch of spoons and syringes in her purse, I don't go, so have you decided that, you know, hard drugs?
No.
I'm not saying any of that, but the real power here lies with our Father, and the Holy Spirit will convict and lead.
Yes.
And I think we just dramatically undervalue what can happen when we simply like do our best to honor our role in a marriage and aggressively pray for our spouse.
That's good.
So I'm just telling you, we've told stories. Who's the guy from Prestonwood that prayed for his wife?
T-Bob Davis.
T-Bob for like 20 years and she returned, right? So
yes,
it happens.
Yes. Yeah. I know that exceptions is the popular thing to talk about when this comes up. I'll just say we're studying Job right now. Job did not sin when he said to his wife, you're talking nonsense, when she said, curse God and die. And he turned her and said, you're talking nonsense, woman. That wasn't sin for him to do that. What he didn't say is, why don't you submit to me better? He's just talking to her as another person. Like, don't, sin is bad. So when you're talking about the crack spoon, I think we can make comments about those things with each other. It's that we get so offended about, why aren't you submitting to me the way that you're supposed to? That I haven't seen that produce good results. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Agreed. I'll bring this home. The points above that we've talked about, just reading a verse in a Bible passage, make a lot of us feel like we're on the outs. I'm going back to my article because I like the way it closed. They make us feel on the outs. Many of us haven't found the satisfaction that family was designed to give us. And we assume that the idea of family is broken and we need to redefine it. That's understandable. But the design actually doesn't have any flaws. It's our execution that has often missed the mark. And I want to say to everybody listening, don't give up. And don't throw in the towel if your family of origin is jacked up. My father didn't. My father's from a broken family in all sorts of ways. Divorce was rampant. Alcohol stained the family tree. His parents didn't really know how to be parents. His divorced mom had my father working at the same bar where she worked, rolling out empty kegs and sweeping up puke deep into the night when my father was just 7 years old. Poverty was normal. My dad picked cotton when he was a 10-year-old on into his teens. And what did he do? Did he say, I've had a bad hand. Bible family isn't really going to happen for me. No. He was born again as a 17-year-old, started following Jesus. In time, he saw the biblical picture of family and saw examples in his church. And he became the patriarch. By the way, that word simply means father-led family. If you're a Bible person, you believe in patriarchy. Of a God-centered family. My sister and I both follow Jesus and we train our kids to do the same. Addiction, divorce, and poverty ended with my father. He changed the story of our generations. I'm on his downline and I'll be grateful through eternity. So if your family's story royally bites like his did, do what he did. Change the story. Even, watch this, if you're the source of the chaos, you can repent of old brokenness. And you can start following the God model that leads to life. You can reinvent your family. You can be a heroic, Abrahamic, family-building stud like my dad. The peace, love, acceptance, and confidence we're meant to find in family, even if it wasn't there for you, can be there for the generations that follow you. They can. Be Abrahamic and move to a place you might have only read about and never experienced. Get to know where you're headed in the scriptures and in other men and in good books. Know how your designer father intended family and follow that plan to your everlasting bliss. And the kicker is, when men like you band together with each other, we start finding ourselves naturally forming neighborhoods and businesses and entire city cultures that are deep, healed, whole, and strong. If you want to change the world, lead your family. Don't lead it the way you think it ought to be. Lead it according to God's plan. All right. Thank you, everybody. You can be that generation. You must be that generation. Be an Abrahamic leader. See you next time.